Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Today we begin a special four-part series on gunfighters of the Old West. Jesse James, Wyatt Earp, Billy the Kid, all heroes. But why? Weren't they just cold-blooded killers? Why have we chosen to make them the stuff of legends? What were their lives really like? We've set aside four shows and assembled eight historians to answer these and other related questions. But before we begin, let's look back at this week in history. On January 7th, 1789, the United States held its first presidential election. But no one went to the polls. Instead, electors in each state appointed by their state legislatures cast their ballots. Each state was allowed as many electors as they had members of the House of Representatives and Senate. And each elector was asked to cast two votes. The person with the majority of votes was to be president. The second highest would become vice president. Political parties were not taken into consideration, which was fine because there weren't any yet. 3 months later, ballots from all the states were counted before a joint meeting of the U.S. House and Senate, and the winner was George Washington. He received one vote from all of the electors, thereby making his election unanimous. The only president to be so elected in American history, and he repeated the feat again in 1792. John Adams was elected vice president in both elections. Turning to this week's history in the news, the U.S. Post Office has issued three new 33-cent stamps to commemorate the men and women of World War II. The stamps depict infantry soldiers led into battle by Uncle Sam, Rosie the Riveter and her famous We Can Do It pose, and a soldier studying in commemoration of the GI Bill. And in an effort to expand and extend the public's memory of Vietnam, the Vietnam Memorial Wall in Washington, D.C., and the more than 58,000 names etched into the granite now appears on the Internet. Web surfers can call up the site, click on a deceased veteran's name, and, in many instances, hear audio files from family members and friends. The website is expected to become the largest single source of oral history regarding individual Vietnam veterans. You're listening to Talking History. The West is central to our understanding of American history, and central to our understanding of the West is the gunfighter, the exploits of whom have become legends, the stuff of American popular culture in Western films, television, and popular fiction. But why have these killers become legends? What is it about them that we admire so much? And what does our making them heroes tell us about ourselves? We're devoting four shows to this subject, and here today to get us started is one of the leading experts on the subject, Richard Slotkin. Richard Slotkin is Olin Professor of American Studies at Wesleyan University. He's the author of a prize-winning three-volume study of the myth of the frontier as a force in American history, politics, and popular culture, one volume of which, Gunfighter Nation, was a finalist for the National Book Award for Nonfiction in 1992. Welcome, Professor Slotkin.
Thank you.
And thank you for being with us. Let's get right to it. Why have Americans chosen to mythologize? Why have they made heroes out of these killers with guns?
Well, there's a small answer and a large answer. The small answer is that that certain figures, certain individuals became prominent in our history and have become celebrated, figures like Jesse James, Wild Bill Hickok, and so on. But I think the more important aspect of it is that the gunfighter symbolizes in the character of a single individual a larger social phenomenon in American life, which is, I think, uniquely American. And that is the idea that private individuals are entitled to use deadly force in a wide range of circumstances to overcome their ends. This is really a kind of unique cultural and legal combination that we have here, which really sets the United States apart from the other so-called Western democracies. The European model of the state, for example, the state has a monopoly in law of the legitimate use of force. But in the United States, that's simply not the case. Both law and custom sanction private individuals to exercise deadly force in a very wide range of of circumstances. And the gunfighter has become, through a long process, the symbolic figure that stands for this uniquely American right to kill, if you will, the right to use violence.
Is this a kind of vigilante action that you're referring to?
Yes. The phenomenon called vigilantism is a basic part of American history. And the gunfighter, although it's vigilantes are always a group active. Vigilante group is a group of private citizens using violence and force for ends which they regard as being public ends, but which are in fact undertaken against whatever the existing pattern of law may be in their territory. And what we have in the gunfighter is that collective phenomenon boiled down to a single heroic case.
Which I suppose is even more important because that reinforces this whole myth of rugged individualism and taking matters into your own hands.
Well, yes, I think one of the things to look for as you look at the history of violence, and especially I think of this privatization of violence, is that this is a country that has developed along lines of laissez-faire capitalism, somewhat regulated, but with laissez-faire being a kind of ideal. And in the earlier history of the country, when laws involving things like race relations and labor relations were less well defined, private groups of individuals, armed individuals, would use their power to establish versions of law that suited their interests. I give it, for example, in the post-Civil War South, when the government was sponsoring civil rights for freed slaves, the Ku Klux Klan, which is essentially a vigilance organization, used private force to terrorize and overthrow this early 1860s, 1870s attempt to establish civil rights. Later on, during the long period of struggle between early labor unions and the formation of big businesses in particular areas of the economy, worker militias were armed as essentially vigilance organizations to protect their own rights. And employers would hire armies of, they would call them detectives, but they were essentially hired gunslingers who would be brought in to terrorize and break the strike. Most notable instances of that would be the Homestead Strike around Pittsburgh in 1892, where you had private armies, in effect, both labor and management, fighting for possession.
Well, now, the gunfighter myth is tied to the myth of the frontier in general.
Yes.
How do we define that myth?
Well, what happened is for much of American history, the story of the nation has been the story of westward expansion, so that most of our early heroes, the people who came to be symbols of American nationality, were drawn from this frontier framework, and among the figures you have to cite would be, of course, George Washington, who's an Indian fighter before he's anything else, and Daniel Boone, Davy Crockett, people of that sort, and fictional figures like Cooper's Hawkeye or Leatherstocking. And these figures were gunmen, riflemen specifically, who used their weapons to fight Indians and clear them out and make the world safe for white American civilization. Gunfighter is a little bit later figure that comes in, and I think what's critical to say about the gunfighter is, as a new phase in this frontier hero, is that whereas the old or traditional frontier hero was always a white man against Indians with a long gun, the gunfighter is as often a white man against other white men. If the Daniel Boone figure is about struggle on the border between whites and reds, between the races, the gunfighter is as much about a struggle between classes of whites within our society as it is with struggles on the border. So you find the gunfighter becoming more prominent as the West, the Old West, closes out after the Civil War, and the country becomes much more absorbed by internal conflicts between whites and blacks and labor and capital.
Why the gun? Why did that become such? Why couldn't it be white man versus white man with fists or with any other kind of weapon?
Well, because because there are two reasons. One is simply realistic. That is, the United States is a heavily armed society from the 18th century onward. The basis of military service is a militia, which requires everyone to own and keep ready firearms. Law enforcement in most cities is by posse comitatus until you get a professional police force towards the beginning of the 20th century, which is to say, if someone yells, "Stop thief," you as a citizen are expected to pull out your six-gun and join the hue and cry. It's true to such an extent that around the turn of the century, Sears used to manufacture men's pants routinely with what they call a pistol pocket. This mass-produced goods, because you're supposed to be armed. So the first thing is, the hero is armed with a gun because that's what Americans were armed with, and that's what Americans were expected to use. And the second thing is, if I'm right, and one of the things the gunfighter is about the private use of power against the law, if need be, to establish your private interests. The gun in this society is the ultimate symbol of force. Fists won't do it. The tool of coercion, the tool of force, is always has to be a deadly weapon, therefore the gun.
How did these myths get started? I mean, myths rely on information being provided for a general audience, a popular
yes.
audience. How does this myth get started?
Well, the general process is this, that if things are happening in the real world, and you have a media which become, towards the end of the century, what we would recognize as mass media. But are pretty massive even earlier than that, popular, I should say, that are looking for stories that will speak to Americans about what the country is about, what the country is, what the meaning of American history is. So you have from a very early point in our history, novelists, journalists, historians, going out west, making tours out west to find material, the material of American history, and bringing back these colorful characters around whom they build stories and legends. Once that basic system is established by, let's say, 1820 or 30, as the tools of media become more capable of producing in quantity, you get a much greater hunger for Western materials, and the legend-making factories really begin to get going.
The film must have been instrumental, I would assume, in spreading this.
Film? Yeah, sure. But film is late. The two big things that really get the boom going are mass circulation magazines with good illustrations that can be reproduced by new processes. And the other big one is the Wild West Show, the Buffalo Bills Wild West Show, which toured all over the country and internationally at the turn of from about 1880 to 19 to World War I, I guess. And was simply the most popular work of entertainment extant in that period. And Buffalo Bill gave his audience a kind of panorama of the history of the West in a series of circus acts, beginning with riflemen of the old West shooting at targets, displaying their skill, and ending with cowboys using pistols, fast draws, displaying their skill.
So the myth or myths of the frontier and the gunfighter pre-exist the kind of mass media, film,
yes.
television we talk about today.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
when,
did it change?
When movies start in 1903, the Western is already there.
Okay.
They don't have to invent it. They go to it.
Does it change when film and television enter into it?
It does. Because you're dealing with such a powerful visual medium, a few things happen. First of all, the technology of violence becomes really interesting. And even things like the technique of the fast draw begin to replace the reality of Old West gunfights, in which the steadier hand and the cooler temperament tended to beat the faster draw. But the faster draw just looks so good on camera that the movie makers are drawn to it. And the other thing that happens, because film repeats a formula over and over again to establish what a Western is, film establishes the idea that the only way a Western-style conflict can ever be settled is with a gunfight. It's almost inconceivable to have a Western that does not end with the moral problem being resolved by means of violence. Whereas in the older versions of the story, you had other options offered. The Western really focuses exclusively on this notion that the only way to settle certain kinds of conflicts is with a gun.
That's a cathartic event. I mean, it's back to your first book in the series, that regeneration through violence. I mean, it builds to that moment, and that seems to clear the air.
That's right.
Interesting.
It clears the air. It settles the question. And it's interesting, if you look in a Western, that very often you'll have a very appealing character, a woman usually, who says, you know, you don't really have to go to the gun. There were other options. And she is almost always proven wrong in a traditional Western movie.
Okay. What happened to the Western in the 1960s? I mean, it seems to have been, started off on a high point and ended up on a low point. What happened?
Well, it's, aesthetically, I'd argue it ended on a high point, but in terms of popularity, the Westerns really go into the dumper in the 70s,
right.
In the early 70s. I think a couple of things happened. There had been a roughly 30-year cycle in which Westerns were the most consistently and frequently produced type of feature film and TV program for almost a 30-year period. They had always been prominent. And to some extent, the genre was simply wearing out its commercial welcome. The other thing I think that happened to the Western was Vietnam and the 60s, and that is that people began to recognize that the code of violence that shapes the Western and the implicitly racist values of the traditional Western were what had gotten us into the violent trouble that we were in, not only in Vietnam, but on the street in the 1960s. And so you get at the end of the 60s, beginning of the 70s, you get a wave of Westerns that are anti-Westerns, that criticize the form itself, like Peckinpah's The Wild Bunch, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. And in the wake of those films, you get the end of the Western. That is, people just stop going, and Hollywood stops making them.
Now, the myth you noted earlier is tied into the Western, but it's actually, from what you've said, separable from. And we only have 2 minutes left, but can you briefly indicate how that myth, has it become separate from the Western?
Yes. The myth briefly states as a story a basic value, and that is that in certain kinds of conflict, the only way to get progress, truth, justice, civilization, the American way, and make the world safe for white women is to commit an act of violence which will possibly take you beyond the law, but you've got to do it anyway. And the same principle, that vigilante principle, you see it in a variety of other popular forms. The urban vigilante movie, you see it in science fiction, you see it in Private Eye type stories, you see it in certain kinds of movies about cops who are kind of treading, like Dirty Harry, who are almost on the wrong side of the law in the process of enforcing the law. And all of these different stories and their different imagery, different styles, are basically telling the same story, laying out the same pattern, that it's the man with the gun who ultimately has to resolve these fundamental questions of value and action in American society.
Okay, well then let me ask you just then to summarize and wrapping us all up a philosophical question. What does this tell us about, if the myth is still alive and well despite all the genres it's gone through, what does this tell us about us as Americans?
I think it tells us that we are a society which, for whom violence is still a very positive value, that we see much to be gained from in both a moral sense and a material sense from the violent resolution of conflict, as opposed to other more compromising forms of interaction. I don't mean to say that we're the most violent society that ever lived, or that we're a bunch of warmongers or anything else. I do think that we tend to look upon issues of violence through the lens of this gunfighter vigilante myth, and it shapes our responses in peculiar ways.
Okay, well, thank you, and that's where we're going to have to end it.
Okay.
Thank you for being with us.
You're quite welcome.
You've been listening to Richard Slotkin, Olin Professor of American Studies at Wesleyan University and author of Gunfighter Nation, The Myth of the Frontier in 20th Century America. You're listening to Talking History.
There was a gun that won the West. There was a man among the best. The fastest gun or man alive. A lightning bolt. the Colt 45.
Just how violent were the gunfighters of the Old West? Are the stories of their now legendary shootouts true or exaggerated? How many people actually engaged in gunfighting or met their death at the end of a gun barrel? This is the subject of this week's op-ed, provided by Richard Etulain. Etulain is a professor of history and director of the Center for the American West at the University of New Mexico. He's the author of The American West, published in 1989, and the award-winning Reimagining the Modern American West, which appeared in 1996. Professor Etulain.
Recently, a good friend asked me if there were any truth in all those lively stories about Western gunfighters. Had those gunmen actually killed dozens of people in vicious, close-range shooting? What should he believe about all those notorious yarns? Well, like many questions, those queries are not easily answered. Yes, men like Wild Bill Hickok, John Wesley Hardin, and several others did engage in gunfights. And yes, dozens of men, even a few women, died in those murderous exchanges. But most of these stories were and are greatly exaggerated. Few men engaged in more than a handful of such shootouts, and that means a limited number of walkdowns occurred at high noon or at sundown on main streets of frontier towns. Much more important is another question. Why did these scattered gunfights take place, especially in cattle towns of the plains and southwest, and in mining towns up and down the Rockies? Well, a number of reasons. Too little law enforcement, too much alcohol, deadly competitions, and bruised egos. These dynamite ingredients, sometimes alone, sometimes together, led to vicious fights, more often with fists, but also frequently with deadly weapons. Now think with me about that hazy twilight zone between the first settlers in an area and later stable communities. In these months, even years of transition, chaotic social situations, unsuccessful sheriffs and policemen, and most of all, fiery tempers led to conflict, often and very quickly. True, men like Wild Bill Hickok and John Wesley Hardin, and to a lesser extent, Billy the Kid and Doc Holliday, were often individualistic, sometimes foolhardy gunfighters. But they have been romanticized well beyond their deeds and significance. On the other hand, Western gunfighters and gunfighting become much more meaningful when seen as one of the shaky, uncertain steps by which frontier crossroads move from wide-open, semi-settled areas toward balanced communities. Consider this. Even if the number and frequency of Western gunfights continue to be overly sensationalized, they were part of the evolving process of community building in more than a few Western towns. So the most important meanings of the gunfighters are the roles they played, sometimes disruptive, sometimes peace-bringing, in the slow, often uncertain movement toward settled communities in the frontier West. That is the most significant fact to remember about Western gunfighting.
You've been listening to Richard Etulain, Professor of History and Director of the Center for the American West at the University of New Mexico. This is Talking History.
Way out here they have a name for rain and wind and fire. Rain is Tess, the fire's Joe, and they call the wind Mariah.
For our site of the week, continuing on the subject of gunfighters of the Old West, we're taking you to one of the best-known old western towns in America, Deadwood, South Dakota. Here to tell us what you will see in Deadwood is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Deadwood, South Dakota is a great representation of the heritage of the American West in the 1800s and 1900s. The gulches of Deadwood were the site of the last America West gold strike, while Bill Hickok and Calamity Jane are buried here. Rumors of gold in the area were mostly ignored because it was surrounded by the Sioux Indian Reservation that was established in 1868. Thanks to the financial panic of 1873, General George Custer's report of gold in 1874 in the Black Hills brought hundreds of people to the region. What began as a city of tents grew into log cabins and frame buildings, and was the source of supplies for mining camps and other nearby towns. Today, you'll find plenty of attractions to keep you busy, including the historic Main and Sherman streets of Deadwood Gulch, and a chance to pan your own gold and an old gold mine, all while you're discovering the rich history of the area. And casinos, introduced in 1989, will let you try your chance at luck with one-armed bandits.
And finally, we turn to this week's coming attractions, television programs, films, museum exhibits, or special events that may interest you. Think you know something about history? Go online to test your wits against history buffs from around the world. The History Bowl National Online History Contest is updated weekly and runs through May. Individuals may compete by school or make up their own teams. For more information, check out the History Bowl website at historybowl.net. And Fort Wayne, Indiana's Lincoln Museum is currently offering an exhibit on the nation's first transcontinental highway. Coast to coast on the Lincoln Highway will run until the end of January. Completed in 1928 as a memorial to Abraham Lincoln, the highway ran from Times Square to San Francisco. For more information, call 219-455-3208. And that's it for another week of Talking History. We hope you've enjoyed the show and that you'll join us next week for the second in our four-part series on Gunfighters of the Old West. We will explore the life and legend of Jesse James. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
When the dust finally settles, one man just lay dead, the other left standing, his gun in his hand. In less than a heartbeat, a lifetime was over. Now one is the victor and one was with the land. But it was a quarrel that neither expected. Cost one a life on that winter's day. But the birds kept on singing, the children kept laughing, and that day and age only two played the game. Now one man's got honor, the other's got nothing to show for the gunfight they had on day. And with disagreement there